Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, Senior Lecturer in Neurology and Neurosurgery at the RVC, University of London, Stephen De Decker. Thank you, Stephen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Good. Thank you very much. Welcome everybody at this webinar. And we're going to discuss this afternoon quite a common neurological emergency, acute paralysis of the hind limbs or paraplegia in dogs. So we'll start immediately with a case. So Poppy is 7 years, 8 month old female neutered Labrador, and she was completely normal until this afternoon. So the owner took Poppy for a walk. They were playing with a tennis ball, and while Poppy was chasing the tennis ball, she suddenly yelps and she could not use her hind limbs anymore. And Poppy is immediately presented to you for further assessment and diagnostics. The problem is a little bit that the owners cannot afford advanced imaging or spinal surgery. So I'll show you a video. So this is Poppy. And you should imagine that Poppy is presented like this to you, but unfortunately, you cannot refer her. And so think about if this is indeed a neurological problem, what do you think the problem could be? And what would you advise the clients? And of course, you can see that Poppy cannot use hind limbs. The spinal reflexes are intact. Good patellar reflexes. Also good withdrawal reflex. So this is a case that we see at the RVC at least once a week. So it's quite a common spinal emergency. So maybe if you have something to write down what you think of this case and what would you do if you see this case yourself. So what will you discuss with the clients of further diagnostics, treatments, and eventual prognosis? And the reason why I started with a case, because maybe this case gave you a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling, because I'm very well aware, although neurology is my passion, most people absolutely hate neurology. And when I discuss with people also why don't you like neurology, several reasons come forward. And people would tell me, because all these cases, you need an MRI or a CT, or you can't do neurology. All neurology patients have a very poor prognosis. Diagnosing or treating them is very expensive, and they can only be managed by specialists. So hopefully, at the end of this session, you will have a slightly different idea. But what is definitely the reality is that a lot of people just kind of panic when they see a neurological case or when they see a neurological emergency. And if you are one of those people that when a neurology case comes into your practice and your confidence sinks bottom, you're not the only one. This is a very well recognized clinical problem, and this is called neurophobia. And you can think it's a bit of a funny word, but it's really a scientific term. There are a lot of studies going on, and it's also in human medicine very well recognized. Neurophobia is really the fear of clinical neurology, and it kind of summarizes that although neurology problems are quite common at 10 to 20%, that even medical students or junior doctors would feel not confident doing neuro exams and assessing neurology patients. If you have an interest in kind of how people learn the science of learning and teaching, this is a very common figure, this triangle, and it shows how by experience, and maybe you can compare this with when you were learning how to drive a car, that you progress with just theoretical knowledge, like a novice, to an expert by taking all these steps, by first you know the theory, then you can apply the theory, then you get more experience, and then you become very proficient. So what happens when you have this neurophobia? This neurophobia really limits you to take these steps. And what we see very typical also with our students at the RVC, that they know very well the theory, but because they don't have any confidence, or you don't have any confidence, that you cannot put your theory into practice. So what we see very well in practice is that there's really this tendency to refer neurology patients to specialists just because they have neurological disease, because of course you have the assumption they all need an MRI anyway. But it's very much true that not all neurology patients need to be referred. You can do a lot yourself in private practice, but also not all neurology patients can be referred. For example, Poppy, the owners don't have any finances, so you have to do something with this dog yourself. What is of course true, you can only do successful management if you have a very reliable differential diagnosis, or most likely diagnosis. And also what happens when you refer cases to us, to the specialists, not all of these cases that we see, even cases like Poppy, do not require further diagnostics like MRI. So just as an introduction, I'll discuss with you how neurology patients are often assessed in private practice, where it starts with incorrect pathways. That would be pattern recognition and phishing. And then the correct pathway, and a little bit the message of this lecture, would be clinical reasoning. So pattern recognition, I think all of us do sometimes pattern recognition. And it's typically a case comes into your practice with clinical signs, and you say, "Oh, I had a case previously with those clinical signs. So it had that disease, so this dog has the same disease." It's very much done by experienced clinicians. And when it works well, is for example when you have quite a common disease with quite unique clinical signs. And this is already one of the reasons why pattern recognition really doesn't work in neurology. And the reason is because it's not only the disease, but maybe more importantly, the localization that determines the clinical signs. So, for example, if you have a chronic disc protrusion here at the thoracolumbar area, or a spinal tumor at exactly the same place, they will present with very similar clinical signs. On the other hand, if you have a disc extrusion here, the thoracolumbar area, or the same disease, a disc extrusion here, high cervical, this dog will present with very different clinical signs. So it's definitely the location that determines the clinical signs, and not necessarily the disease itself. So that's why pattern recognition is not a good idea in neurology. Then something that we get quite often when we get cases referred is what we call phishing. Another word for phishing would be diagnosis by exhaustion. Is that you and what happens is a neurology case comes into your practice. You don't feel confident what you have to do. So what do? You kind of do everything. You do blood work, urine analysis, radiographs of everything. And you hope you will find something. But again, that's not always that useful. And so this would be a very typical case, a very typical referral for us. So this would be typically a dog that has gait abnormalities. And when we see the skull is radiographed, the complete vertebral column, cervical, thoracolumbar, lumbar, lumbosacral, the hips, and several joints. So the problem here is, what happens if you find an abnormality? Maybe it's then even more confusing than before. And what we also, of course, see is that there is this assumption that you need to have an MRI scan to be good at neurology. That's definitely not true, because this phishing can even become problematic when you have an MRI scan. So imagine if you say, "Oh, this dog has a gait abnormality. We should do an MRI." So you do an MRI and it ends like this. And of course, most of you don't have experience in MRI. So somewhere here is the region of where the head will be. So this will be somewhere the thoracolumbar region. And here starts the tail. This gray structure here is a spinal cord. The white surrounding the spinal cord is cerebrospinal fluid. The spinal cord is surrounded by these rectangular structures, which are the vertebral bodies. Here the spinous processes. And between each vertebral body is this structure here, this black structure here, it's more white. That's the intervertebral disc. And when the intervertebral disc becomes degenerate, it turns black. But what you see is here, you see the spinal cord is really compressed, but also here and here. So if you just do an MRI scan because the dog is walking a bit funny, it's not uncommon, especially in older dogs, to have an MRI scan like this with multiple sites of spinal cord compression. Then it's still very difficult to determine which is clinically relevant. And that's why, of course, you should do a neurologic examination. So what is the correct way of doing, of assessing neurology patients? That would be clinical reasoning. And clinical reasoning is now very much accepted in the human medical literature. And the concept of clinical reasoning is a little bit that you can break, even if you have very complex situations. So for example, for most people, a neurology patient would be complex. Break it down in very easy to answer questions. And I would always be, for example, define the problem, define the system. And I mean, is it neurological or can it be something else? Define the location and define the lesion. And often what happens is that people try to jump all these steps and try to immediately discuss the lesion. But if you don't consider all these steps, it's very likely you will have difficulties over here. And it's also with our students. Often when I ask, what do you think? They say, oh, I don't know, it's very difficult. But then when we go step by step, even if they don't have an expert knowledge about neurology, they will come to something useful at the end. And that's the aim of this lecture. So of course, first things first, don't panic. Stay calm. A neurology patient is exactly the same as any other patient. You start with a good clinical history. Sometimes the clinical history is everything you have. And something, and an example would be, for example, a dog with seizures. Then a general physical examination. Again, very important because some systemic diseases, such as polyarthritis, might mimic neurological disease. And then a neurological examination. And always when you go to lectures from a neurologist, they will tell you, oh, you have to do a neurologic examination because you have to answer, is the animal having a neurological problem, yes or no? And if the animal has a neurological problem, which part of the nervous system is affected? And maybe by now you're already sick and tired of hearing all those neurologists telling you that you have to do a neurological examination. But if you remember this patient that was referred to us, imagine if you would have taken the time and if you would have had the confidence to do a neuro exam and you would have decided that it was already neurological, it should not have been necessary to take all these radiographs of the joints. If you would have done a neuro exam, you would have decided it was a neck problem. Then again, it would not have been necessary to take the radiographs of the complete vertebral column, but only those two radiographs would have been sufficient. And then it would have been much easier for you to look at those radiographs into detail and find possible clues for your underlying condition. So, like I said, one of the aims of the neuro exam is recognize if a patient has neurological disease. And even for us, this is not always easy, even with acute spinal disease. But what might help you is the knowledge that when an animal becomes progressively paralyzed, that they get neurological deficits in a very specific order. So with acute spinal disease, really acute, because it's not the same for chronic, animals first get proprioceptive deficits. Only after that, they will get abnormalities in gait. So they get paresis and ataxia that progresses to plegia. Then they, and the difference is that with paresis, you're weak, but you still can move your limbs. Plegia is complete paralysis. Then you lose function of your bladder, function of your tail. And the very last thing that disappears is pain sensation. And when an animal recovers, it's the opposite. So first, pain sensation comes back. Then they can wag their tail, the bladder works, then they will get movement in their pelvic limb. So that has a few practical consequences. So that when and that proprioceptive deficits will occur before the animal becomes paretic or ataxic. So that means that proprioceptive deficits are very handy to recognize an animal with acute spinal cord injury, and that all animals with an acute spinal cord injury and abnormal gait will have proprioceptive deficits. But also very important is we know that pain sensation is only the last thing to disappear. So in most, I think probably in 80-85% of the neurologic examinations I perform myself, I do not test pain sensation. And the reason is because dogs and of course people don't like that you crunch their toes with an artery forceps. So, and we know that if the animal can still walk or has good voluntary motor function in the hind limbs, it will have pain sensation. So I only test pain sensation in completely paralyzed animals. So this practical will come in the second video. So this was an Rottweiler that was referred to us for acute spinal disease. And you see he has a gait abnormality affecting both of his pelvic limbs. So he was referred for an MRI scan. As you can see, it's also an extremely friendly Rottweiler. And this gait really looks like ataxia and paraparesis. So I think all of you would agree that it's not a bad idea to refer this dog for suspected neurology problem. But now I'm going to test proprioception. Very important proprioception is that you support the animal. So if I support him, he has good proprioception. So here, and now I support him, good proprioception. And also on the other side, it's very important again to support his weight. So I support now his weight and a very good proprioception. So only based on proprioception and the knowledge that an animal with acute spinal disease and a gait abnormality should have proprioceptive deficits, it was very unlikely for me that this dog had an acute spinal problem. So I asked the orthopedic surgeons to have a look, and this dog had a bilateral cruciate disease. So just by this simple test, we could already avoid doing an MRI scan in a dog with orthopedic disease. So the message here is that proprioception, testing of proprioception, is a very sensitive indicator for acute spinal disease. Like I said again, not all dogs with chronic spinal disease have proprioceptive deficits. So of course, what happens next? Next, you have to create a list of differential diagnoses. So you're here now at number four, define the lesion. And what happens too often is that people say, oh, your dog has a neurological problem, so you need an MRI scan. No, now you have to come up with differentials, and only after you have differentials, you have to discuss possible diagnostics, treatment, and prognosis for your patients. So we're going to discuss how we do this. So, and this is especially my belief is that having a list of only the two or three most likely differentials based on clinical reasoning, based on clinical assessment, is really the key factor for being successful in neurology in private practice. So most of us have learned using the DAMNIT V scheme or vitamin D scheme in practice, but we don't use this anymore. Also now when we teach our students or when we have students in clinics, we avoid using the DAMNIT V or vitamin D scheme. And why? Our experience is a little bit, if you use this scheme, you will end up with all possible differentials, but not necessarily the most likely differentials. And in neurology, we want to know what are the most likely differentials. And often, of course, you remember the most exotic differentials first. So we don't use the DAMNIT V anymore because it's not specific for your patient. So what we use, or what we believe, is that most disorders and definitely acute spinal conditions, that they are associated with very specific clinical characteristics. And those clinical characteristics are very easy to recognize. And if you consider those characteristics, it will be possible for you to create a list of only the two, maximum three, most likely differentials. So again, we don't want all the differentials in the world. We only want the most likely differentials. And the characteristics you have to use are the onset of clinical sign, the progression of clinical signs, symmetry, pain, and signalements. And of course, we'll discuss all of them briefly. So of course, because I work in an academic teaching in a university, we want to put this in a teaching tool. So we call this the five-finger rule, or if we start with localization, it's called the six-finger rule. So how does the six-finger rule start? We start with localization. So unfortunately, the five-finger rule does not replace doing a good neuro exam. So you localize all to the forebrain, all to the brainstem, all cerebellum, neuromuscular, or spinal cord. And then when you come at spinal cord, it's probably important to say if it's all a cervical lesion, thoracolumbar, or lumbosacral, or if you're already more advanced, you can even localize to all the C1, C5, C62, T3L3, or the L4, S3 spinal cord segments. And why is this important? Because a lot of spinal conditions will again affect specifically or preferentially a specific part of the spinal cord. So, for example, cervical spondylomyelopathy or wobbler syndrome will affect the caudal portion of the neck, while atlantoaxial subluxation will never affect lumbosacral, but the craniocervical junction. So still very important. So after that comes the onset of the disease. And all of you know disorders are typically acute and disorders that are typically chronic. But what is extremely important in animals with acute spinal cord injuries is paracute onset of disease. So what is paracute onset of disease? It's like the first case you have seen, Poppy. It's a dog, it's completely normal. And only in a few seconds, from one moment to the other, the dog is paralyzed. And typically, your owner was, I was looking at my dog, and suddenly my dog was paralyzed. That's paracute. And a paracute onset of disease is more common than you think. And it's associated with very specific very specific differential diagnosis. So then the progression of the disease. Of course, you know a lot of progressive disorders. For example, a tumor is progressive, inflammatory disease is progressive. But again, there are conditions that might have a tendency to improve by themselves. And that's, for example, a vascular disease like an ischemic myelopathy, an FCE, or an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. And those are the diseases where it's not uncommon that your client says, "Oh, this morning my dog was paracutely paralyzed, but now he starts to use his leg a little bit better again." Very easy to recognize, but very important because it's associated with very specific clinical characteristics. Intermittent is also important. And what would be typically intermittent are neck problems. So when a client tells me, "Oh, my dog just once in a while screams in pain," for me, that sounds already quite suspicious for a neck problem. Also, lumbosacral problems typically can get acutely worse during activity. So, symmetry of clinical signs. Some disorders can be clearly asymmetrical. And what I mean with clearly asymmetrical is that even your client will say that, "Oh, my dog is dragging his right hind leg, but his left hind leg is walking quite normally." Again, this is very easy to recognize for you, but if you see an asymmetrical or lateralized clinical signs, it's again associated with very specific conditions. And again, this ischemic myelopathy or fibrocartilaginous embolism, and this very specific type of disc extrusion that we call an ANNPE. And also, disorders of the cauda equina, like caudalumbar disc extrusions, or lumbosacral disease can also be asymmetrical. And degenerative myelopathy, for example, in German Shepherds, can be asymmetrical only in the early stages of the disease. Also, an important one is pain. And maybe it's important to recognize that in the spinal cord itself, this green structure, Yeah, no pain receptors. So if you have a condition that affects the spinal cord itself, like an intramedullary spinal cord tumor or contusion of the spinal cord, it's typically non-painful. But when you have all the structures surrounding the spinal cord, like the meninges, the vertebrae, the spinal nerves, the intervertebral disc, they have an abundance on pain receptors. So for example, that's the reason why, for example, meningitis is so painful. So some conditions that affect the spinal cord itself are typically non-painful, and that would be again fibrocartilaginous embolism, degenerative myelopathy, spinal cord contusion. Some conditions that you would expect to be painful are not always painful. And a classic example would be a dachshund with an intervertebral disc extrusion. Typically, the clinical history starts with pain, but then when they start becoming paralyzed, they are not that obviously painful anymore. So how I use this pain finger would be if your animal is painful on spinal palpation, you can exclude all those non-painful conditions. But if you cannot elicit a clear painful response, I would be careful and not immediately rule out classical painful conditions such as compressive intervertebral disc disease. And then last but not least, Sinelmeant. Why do we say last but not least? Because it's probably the least reliable factor. Because if you base too much on Sinelmeant, then of course you think that every dachshund has an intervertebral disc extrusion. What is however important is that dogs have very different spinal problems than cats. Conditions that are very common in dogs are very uncommon in cats or do not even exist in cats. So when you see a cat with spinal disease, you should have very different differential diagnosis. So of course you can think that this five finger rule or this six finger rule or this clinical reasoning in spinal disease is a little bit of a fantasy of ours or something that we believe in, but it's not necessarily true. So we have published relatively recently this paper in Veterinary Records where we evaluate if we would apply that clinical reasoning, if it indeed would make sense. And that study had, of course, a few interesting results. And what is interesting is that when we looked at 500 dogs with spinal disease, they were represented by the 26 diseases, but 91% of animals with spinal disease were represented by only 10 diseases. So if you know the clinical characteristics of those 10 conditions, then you will already be able to hopefully help 91% of your patients. And the one in yellow are very important for this lecture because, like I said, acute hindlimb paralysis is quite a common emergency that we get, but it's only associated with a few differentials. And the four most likely differentials for you when you see an animal with acute hindlimb paralysis or dog with acute hindlimb paralysis would be, of course, a type 1 intervertebral disc extrusion, ischemic myelopathy, which is fibrocartilaginous embolism, or this disease, which here is referred to as a high velocity, low volume disc extrusion. Another name for this disease is an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. And I mentioned four diseases. The fourth disease would be a fracture or luxation, but they are typically quite easy to recognize for you. So when you see an animal with an acute onset of acute hindlimb paralysis, it's kind of a message to recognize or try to differentiate between those three conditions. And you will see in the next cases that you can use clinical reasoning and a five-finger rule very well here because those conditions have a very different type of treatment. So I don't think this is very obvious for you on your slides. It's also not that important for you. It was just to show you that if we apply statistically this five-finger rule, that it indeed makes sense and that the eight most common spinal conditions in dogs are indeed significantly associated with those easily to recognize clinical variables such as Sinelmeant, onset of clinical signs, progression of clinical signs, pain on palpation, and symmetry. So we will illustrate this with a few cases. So the first case is Diesel, and Diesel is a 7-year-old male Neuter Mustafi. Again, completely normal this morning. Then he was running in a field, suddenly yelped, and was paralyzed. And this is a very, very common clinical scenario that we see. And then when he comes at your practice a few hours later, the owner says he seems to have improved already slightly. So here are already two very important clinical characteristics that are very easy for you to recognize: a paracute onset of clinical signs, and the dog has improved already slightly. But you have to be confident to listen to your clients and to ask those specific questions. So this is Diesel. We'll show you the video. So you see he cannot use his hind limbs. So it looks quite dramatic. Then when we hold him at the base of the tail here, you can see that the right pelvic limb is moving quite well, but the left is dragging. And like I said, you don't have to be a neurologist to recognize this. So all of you can recognize that Diesel has asymmetrical clinical signs, and we'll see again. So you see this leg is moving, but the other one is just dragging. So all of you can see it's quite asymmetrical. Proprioception, the dog has absent proprioception. So you can be 100% sure that the dog has a neurological problem. So proprioception is a very sensitive indicator for neurological disease. Then we test spinal reflexes. The withdrawal reflex is absent. And why do we test spinal reflexes? Spinal reflexes have nothing to do with severity of clinical signs. The only reason why we test spinal reflexes is to evaluate the localization. So if this reflex is, if this reflex is intact, then we know that the reflex is, then we know that the reflex is not located in this reflex arc, but it's located cranially from it. So it's good patellas. And he also has an intact cuneus truncus reflex. We do spinal palpation. You see, the dog is not obviously painful on spinal palpation. And the last thing that we'll do in the video is testing for pain sensation. And like I said, we will only test pain sensation in the completely paralyzed dog. And you see why the dog really doesn't like it. So, in summary, you could see the dog was non-ambulatory, so he was kind of paralyzed of the hind limbs. The clinical signs were quite asymmetrical, because he still has quite good movement in the right pelvic limb. Absent withdrawal reflex, no pain on spinal palpation, and intact sensation. And with this information, you can do quite a lot. So this is again a little bit of a summary of the neuro exam. So this is a case where you can answer a lot of questions without any further diagnostics. So you can answer it. Do you think the dog is neurologically normal, or do you think it can be something else? Maybe it can be something orthopedic. You can answer if the dog is neurologically normal, what is the neurotomic localization, and what are your main differentials for this presentation? So is the dog neurologically normal? Definitely not. You can be 100% confident this dog has a neurological problem because of the absence of proprioception. Second question, where would you localize this problem? It was quite obvious that the dog only had problems in his hind limbs. So the problem is all localized in this segment, what we call the T3L3 spinal cord segment, or L4S3. How do we differentiate between T3L3 or L4S3? That's with the spinal reflexes. Spinal reflex, if it's intact, this is working, and the problem will be localized here. If the spinal reflexes, like the withdrawal and patella, are not working, the problem is localized in this reflex arc. So the patella reflex was good, but the withdrawal reflex was absent. So in this dog, you can say that it has a problem in the reflex arc in the L4 S3 spinal cord segments. So now you can tell your client it's definitely neurological. He has a problem in his spinal cord and more in the caudal part of his spinal cord. Now, of course, comes the most important. What is your differential for this dog? And like I said, we only go for the two most likely differentials in this dog. So if you are a student at the RVC, then you get a little bit brainwashed. And then when you come at, on clinics, you have to present this case. And then typically you should say that Diesel presents with a paracute onset of asymmetrical, non-painful, spontaneously improving L4 S3 myelopathy. And when we think about differentials, of course, the most common is a type 1 disc extrusion. But if I ask you, is it that common for disc extrusion to occur paracute just in seconds? It's definitely not. I have never, ever seen a type 1 disc extrusion where clinical signs occur just in a few seconds. So a paracute onset, very unlikely. Would be an asymmetrical, such asymmetry would be typical for intervertebral disc extrusion. It is possible, but again, quite unlikely. Again, most animals with an intervertebral disc extrusion are painful, not all. But again, an important one is this dog is improving already by himself. And as most of you know, is a disc extrusion has the tendency to get gradually worse if you don't do anything. So two very important factors, or three: the paracute onset of clinical signs, spontaneously improving, and asymmetrical. And all those things, because the challenge now is find a differential that fits with all those five fingers, and a disc extrusion does not fit with all those five fingers. So if we take it here, when we consider a paracute onset of clinical signs, there are only three conditions that can have a paracute onset of clinical signs. One would be trauma, fracture luxation. The other one would be vascular, a fibrocartilaginous embolism. And the other one would be this acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, or ANNPE. Clinical signs are very lateralized. In which of those three conditions is it possible? It can happen in all three, although less likely in trauma. But the dog is improving by itself. A trauma will not improve by itself, like a fracture luxation will not improve by itself. So which are the two most likely differentials for this dog, just based on his clinical presentation and following the principles of clinical reasoning? We discuss with this client that the dog very likely has a fibrocartilaginous embolism or an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. So most of you have probably not heard of what is an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. To understand what is this, you have to have a little bit of a basic knowledge of the anatomy of the intervertebral disc. So the anatomy of the intervertebral disc consists of two components, one very central part, which is here, which is the nucleus pulposus, and then it's also here, the nucleus pulposus. And normally the nucleus pulposus is very gel-like. It contains a lot of water. And I often tell my clients the nucleus pulposus is a little bit as a water balloon, absorbing all the forces of that reach the vertebral column. And that water balloon is kept in place by these collagen layers. That's called the annulus fibrosis. So what happens during an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion is that for some reason, it can be a trauma or it can be very intense exercise like chasing a tennis ball, the pressure in this disc gets too much and is otherwise completely healthy and hydrated disc ruptures, and from 1 second to the other second, all this fluid escapes, bashes against the spinal cord, causes spinal cord contusion, but because it's fluid, it all dissipates and there's no spinal cord compression. So the owners of Diesel wanted an MRI, and it looks a bit like this. So this is spinal cord. Here again are the vertebral bodies. You see, between each vertebral body is white structure. It's the intervertebral disc, and then a healthy, fluidy intervertebral disc looks white on the MRI. You see, it's a bit smaller because some of that white fluid has exploded and has smashed against the spinal cord, is causing here a contusion. That's the white you can see, but there's no spinal cord compression. So this dog does not require surgery at all. And this condition should definitely not be confused at all with degenerative intervertebral disc disease or type 1 intervertebral disc disease. Also, it's a completely different disease, and these dogs are also not at risk of getting compressive degenerative intervertebral disc disease later in life. They are completely separate conditions. So you will find other names in the literature. One name that is quite inappropriate, but it's quite difficult to explain is type 3 intervertebral disc extrusion. So that's something we definitely don't use. But like I said, it can happen during trauma. So initially it was called a traumatic intervertebral disc extrusion. Also, a description that we use quite often is a high velocity, low volume disc extrusion, because with a very high velocity, only a small volume of this disc bashes against the spinal cord. But the name that is now accepted and used most commonly would be an acute, non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, and it describes very well what happens, especially it's non-compressive. So what is important? There's no spinal cord compression, so surgery is never indicated in these cases. So it's medical management, and medical management is intense physiotherapy and intense hydrotherapy. And if they still have pain sensation like Diesel, then prognosis for functional recovery is quite good. So this is Diesel the next day. So the owners wanted MRI, and we diagnose an ANP, and this is then the next day, and you see, of course, miracles don't happen, but you see that his function, especially in that right pelvic limb, has already improved further the next day. So this is a case that you can recognize just based on considering the clinical characteristics of Diesel. And without any invasive treatment, you see already an obvious improvement after 1 day. So I discussed with you that there was also another differential, and that was a fibrocartilaginous embolism or an ischemic myelopathy, vascular disease. So what is that? So if this is a spinal cord, then there are of course blood vessels going to the spinal cord. And what happens in a fibrocartilaginous embolism? Again, if suddenly from 1 second to the other second, a piece of fibrocartilage gets stuck into a blood vessel, the spinal cord does not get any blood flow. So you can compare it a little bit with an infarct of the spinal cord. And again, this has a very similar clinical presentation as dogs with an ANP. Clinical presentation is almost impossible to differentiate. Paracute onset, often lateralized clinical signs, because of course it's only in one blood vessel. Non-progressive, often spontaneously improving, quite non-painful conditions. So also fibrocartilaginous embolism, so they almost have an identical clinical presentation. So paracute onset clinical signs, often during strenuous activity, such as running after a tennis ball or chasing a frisbee. Again, this is a non-surgical condition. So surgery is never indicated. Treatment is physiotherapy or hydrotherapy. What is important, that although these dogs often have a good prognosis, it can take up to 2 weeks till you see improvement. And we'll come back to this at the end of this lecture. You have to have realistic expectations when you manage spinal patients in your practice. And again, prognosis is often good. So These are two very, very common conditions: an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposa extrusion and a fibrocartilaginous embolism. We see several every week. And if I want you to remember one thing from this lecture, is how to recognize them, because they are two non-surgical emergencies. So if you can recognize them, you can even consider managing these cases into your own practice. So typically it's in adult large breed dogs, so not the typical Dachshunds. Paracute onset of clinical signs are really the hallmark. Really, when your client says from one second to the other second, the dog was paralyzed when he was chasing a tennis ball, that should really be a red flag for these conditions. NP can also happen during trauma, often non-painful, although an NP can be slightly painful in the first 24 hours. It is possible in these conditions that clinical signs are very lateralized, as you have seen in Poppy, that one leg is moving, the other leg is just dragging. It's, however, not necessary. So how it works is, if the dog has very lateralized clinical signs, these are your top differentials. But if your dog has just paralysis of both hind limbs, you cannot exclude this condition. And also very obvious or very important, these conditions do not get worse. Every spinal cord condition can get worse in the first 24 hours, but after initial period, these two conditions should not get worse. And that's very important, because sometimes we make this presumptive diagnosis, and then when we discuss a plan with the clients, would be we keep the dog here. But if he gets any worse after today, we have to revise our differential diagnosis. So, for example, if you make this differential diagnosis, but after 2 days your dog suddenly starts to deteriorate, it's very likely another condition. So how does this clinical reasoning works in practice? So of course you have to do a neurologic examination. There's no way around it. So you really have to answer, is this a neurological problem, yes or no? And as you have seen with the Rottweiler, it's not always that easy. Then you have to get a neuroanatomical localization. Most important, you have to see if it's a neck problem, a thoracolumbar problem, or a lumbosacral problem. Very important, and I think that's the secret of being good in neurology in private practice: obtain a list of only the most likely differentials. Do not get a list of all possible differentials in the world. And you have seen that recognizing or considering very easy to recognize clinical characteristics can really be helpful. And only after this, you discuss with your client further diagnostics and treatment options. So, for example, with Diesel, and it happens often, is that the referring vets discusses with the client, I think your dog has or a fibrocartilaginous embolism or an ANPE. If you want to have confirmed, we have to do further diagnostics. Treatment will be physiotherapy, hydrotherapy. This can be done here, or you have to go to a referral center. But we see more and more patients that come very well informed by the referring vets, and that's wonderful to see. And then, of course, you have to start appropriate treatment, but very, very important, realistic expectations. So this comes back to Poppy. And maybe in the case of Diesel, you have recognized Poppy a little bit, because Poppy was also completely normal. And then when she was playing with a tennis ball, she screamed. She could not use her hind limbs anymore. She's referred to you. And then when she is presented to you, the dog has not deteriorated any further. And you might remember again the clinical presentation for Poppy with the video. So again, you see she cannot use her hind limbs. But if you see well, but it's not as obvious, she again has movement in the right a little bit, but not in the left, and will probably go a little bit back. And then you see that she maybe again, yeah. And then you will see when the shot changes that she has some movement in the right, but not in the left. Then, of course, is the question, is this neurological or can this be something else? It's 100% neurological, because Poppy has absent proprioception. So now what we want to do is localize, so the front limbs are normal, So it's or T3, L3, or L4, S3. How do we differentiate between T3, L3, L4 with the spinal reflexes? If they are intact, then we know that this reflex arc is working and the problem will be likely localized somewhere here. So the patellas are good. Also, the withdrawal is good. So we think the lesion is localized in this segment, which we refer to as the T3, L3 spinal cord segments. And although Poppy is very stressed, she doesn't seem to be in pain. So when we summarize her neurological examination, we would say again that she has a paracute onset, asymmetrical, non-painful, non-progressive T3, L3 myelopathy. And even when these cases come to us, we don't always do further diagnostics. So based only on the clinical presentation, this typical paracute onset of clinical signs and being non-painful, non-progressive, slightly asymmetrical, we discussed with the client that the dog would very likely or has a fibrocartilaginous embolism or a non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. Of course, I see these cases quite often, so I was quite confident with those differentials. Poppy was not insured, so I told the clients that if they have limited funds, that I'm even so confident that I'm 95% sure, and maybe we should spend the funds that they have in physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, instead of doing an MRI scan. So the clients followed, and of course, I said Poppy stays here, and if she gets a bit worse after 2 to 3 days, then maybe we have to revise our diagnosis. So we started appropriate treatment. Very important when I say have realistic expectations, also discuss those expectations with your clients that they don't expect immediately miracles. So we start appropriate treatment, and this is then, I think, 3 days after initial clinical presentation. You see, Poppy has not dramatically improved. She's very similar as when she presented. She can now maybe support her weight a little bit better. That's without the sling, so she can support her weight. But then when we look at the other video, we see, of course, it's a Labrador. She likes swimming, and we see in this right pelvic limb something is moving, and the left pelvic limb not really. And especially when we start the video again, we see that in the right pelvic limb something is moving, but not in the left pelvic limb. So very important, Poppy has not dramatically improved after 3 days, but she has not deteriorated. And that's why we see what I see quite often is that now more and more vets become very comfortable making a differential diagnosis and discussing with the clients, oh, I think your dog has very likely ONFC on ANP, but then the next day the dog is not better and you lose your confidence. It's very normal that most dogs need several days before they show any sign of improvement. And this is again a very critical point where the dog is hospitalized, you start physiotherapy, you start hydrotherapy, but you don't immediately see a change, and that's completely normal. So this dog was with us, and of course we are very confident. We can offer them a lot of attention. So this is again 2 days later. And maybe if you're a very positive person, you'll see that function in the right pelvic has again improved. So that's 5 days after initial presentation. And she starts wagging her tail, and maybe a little bit movement is coming in the left. But again, very subtle. And that's also why I said with realistic expectations, you have to discuss this from the beginning with your clients. So I told my clients, we start immediate treatment, don't expect improvement in the first couple of days. And this is then the next day, the video. And again, you see now that also in the left pelvic limb, maybe a little bit of movement is coming. But again, the dog is still severely affected. So this was 6 days after presentation, the 18th of January. The 19th, Poppy was discharged. So what is very important is that when you see these cases, the first important step is have a list of reliable differentials. So only the two or three most likely differentials. What is a misconception is to believe that animals with neurological disease have a poor prognosis. Often they have very good recoveries. I think they even have better recoveries than people with spinal conditions. But what is very important is that these animals should be given the opportunity to improve. Animals, it typically takes weeks for them to get back to relatively normal, and you should not expect improvement in this in the first day. So whatever the condition is, what I typically tell my client is we make a diagnosis, then we do not expect any improvement in the first few days. After that, I will see subtle improvement, which is probably very difficult for them to recognize. When the animal can urinate voluntarily, it can go home by itself, but it can go home. And only when the animal comes back for a recheck, 4 to 6 weeks after diagnosis, it should be able to walk, but very abnormal. And it's very important you discuss this plan with your clients. For example, I discussed this with the owners of Poppy, and it was very easy for them to accept what would happen every day. And like I said, with some cases, it can take up to 14 days until you see any improvement. And this is also what we discuss with our clients. For example, if we call them every day and we say, "Oh, today Poppy is the same, Poppy is the same, Poppy is the same," we always tell them if after 2 weeks we have not seen any sign of improvement, we will probably consider that Poppy will not improve anymore. And like I said, it's very normal when these dogs come for their recheck that they are still walking very abnormally. And then after that, we typically see further improvement until up to 6 months after the injury. So Poppy was, sorry, it's also, sorry, I was a little bit ahead here. So it's also illustrated in a paper that we published, I think last year or the year before, where we compared the clinical signs and outcomes of dogs with an ischemic myelopathy, like a fibrocartilaginous embolism, and dogs with this non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. What is very important is when you see at the time from first onset of first improvement, it can go very quick. In a lot of dogs, it goes very quick, like you could see in Diesel, the Staffy. But you see it can take up to 2 weeks before you see any improvement. Time till they can urinate by themselves. It can go very quick, but it can take up to 2 weeks. And then very important is ambulatory at discharge. So could these dogs walk when we would send them home? Approximately half of dogs with the fibrocartilage embolism could walk. So a lot of them go home non-walking, but able to urinate. And then also very important, how long does it take for these dogs to be able to walk by themselves? Again, it can go quick, but it can take like these dogs, it can take more than 2 months. But still, these dogs had a very positive outcome without invasive or expensive treatment. And again, it's a little bit highlighted in the table here. It's just a previous table, but again, bigger. And it's more to illustrate to you, and it's like something that I see very commonly, that you hospitalize a paralyzed dog, and then 2, 3 days later, suddenly the mood changes, or some of your colleagues start saying, "Oh, your patient has still not improved. This is sad for the dog. You should not continue. You should put your dog to sleep." Maybe some of your nurses start being involved. It is very, very normal when you have a paralyzed animal that will have a very good outcome, that you will not see improvement in the first couple of days. And what you can do when you see these cases and you don't see the improvement you were hoping for, just give us a call, and then hopefully we can help you over the phone. So Poppy was discharged the 19th. The 24th, she came back for hydrotherapy, and you can see again a little bit of improvement, not spectacular, but you see that she now also starts using that left hind limb Much better. So Poppy was one of these cases where we did not do any diagnostics. We just said based on the clinical characteristics, I think your dog has a non-surgical spinal emergency, and with physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, it's very likely to improve, but you have to give us time. And then, like I said, a month after the onset of clinical signs, the 13th, when they came for the recheck, Poppy is walking. So she's walking, but not normal. So I discussed with the client, it's very normal that now, a month after the onset of clinical signs, but don't forget that a month ago this dog was paralyzed. Your dog will walk like this, and in the next couple of days, weeks, and months, this will improve even further. So, of course, then, how should you look after these patients? It's very similar as with every emergency. When they come to you, don't focus immediately on the neurological aspect because maybe they have they're multi-trauma patients. So first, follow your normal steps of emergency management. Fluid therapy. All animals with acute spinal cord injury need fluid therapy just to maintain spinal cord perfusion. And typically, we place them just on maintenance fluid. If you think they are painful, even if you're not convinced, give them appropriate analgesia. But first, check, of course, nociception because you don't want to load your dog with methadone and morphine. And then evaluate pain perception because it might be quite complicated. And then, of course, appropriate nursing care. We'll discuss this in the next few slides. And bladder management. This is the most important when you look after paralyzed patients, bladder management. You should assume they cannot urinate by themselves. And when you see a paralyzed patient, they will not die because they cannot use their hind limbs. But if you don't recognize that they cannot urinate, they can have life-threatening complications. We even had patients where the bladder just pops, and animals need to be presented for emergency bladder surgery. Just a short word about steroids. I think, especially in UK, people are not using that often steroids anymore, which is very good. Because I think until 10 years ago, it was believed that if you have an animal with acute neurological disease, you should give very high dose of steroids as soon as possible, because it was believed that it would act as a free radical scavenger. But first in human medicine, there were quite extensive studies that showed that these doses of steroids do not have any beneficial effect and would even increase the risk of potentially life-threatening complications. And we see the same now in veterinary studies. So there are some veterinary studies. One of them is this study from the group of Texas, where they compared animals that received or did not receive steroids after acute spinal cord injury. And they would see that it did not make any beneficial effect, but these animals were 3.4 times more likely to have a complication such as gastrointestinal ulceration, aspiration pneumonia. So we never ever give any more steroids in animals with acute spinal cord injury. So, what is also very important is prevention of secondary complications. Urinary tract infection is very common, also with us, just something to keep an eye on, of course, and then a bladder rupture, bladder atonia, and then all skin-related problems. Also very important, joint and muscle contractions. And something that is often overlooked is to enhance the mental well-being. So, prevention is, of course, much easier and cure because, like this dog here who has a decubital ulcer, also here, these decubital ulcers can be more frustrating and more expensive to treat than the spinal cord injury. And also here, because of course these dogs are can be incontinent, urine is leaking, so they can get urine scalding. So they need good nursing care. So typically, you have soft and very clean bedding. We typically, if they cannot position himself in sternal recumbency, we would do turning every 4 hours. Physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, especially in the last years, has gained a lot of importance. And I have seen dogs that were paralyzed, but otherwise with a good prognosis, but because they did not receive any form of physio hydrotherapy, they developed a contracture, a joint contracture or muscle contraction, of course. Unfortunately, those are irreversible complications, and it's really a shame that when that dog then recovers a spinal cord function, that he cannot walk because if he has a joint or muscle contracture. Of course, the same as with people, when people are for a few days in the hospital, they become a bit depressed. Dogs can have the same, so they need a lot of TLC. Luckily, we have a lot of nurses who are fantastic. But also, if possible, try to take those dogs out when the sun is shining, just on the grass, and hopefully they will be much better. Like I said, bladder management is most important. Really, really consider that they cannot urinate until they have proven otherwise. It's extremely important and the cornerstone of treatment. Also, in our hospital, the decision to send them home or keep in a hospital is mainly based on the fact if they can urinate voluntarily or not. So, of course, you can have all types of complications if you don't manage bladder function well. And the three methods that we typically use would be manual bladder expression that we do in the majority, probably 90, 95% of cases. In some cases, get repeated aseptic catheterization. In some cases, we'll get a catheter for a few days. So I only have one case, and I'm finished here because this is a classic, but also a classic that is quite often referred to us in this shape and form. It's a 3-year-old male dachshund, Bertie, and since yesterday he has spinal pain and reluctance to jump, so he is referred to you. And my question is, maybe again, if you have something to write, what would you do with this dog? Would you do which diagnostics? Would you refer the dog? So it's quite obvious that Bertie can still walk. Just proprioception. Like I said, proprioception disappears before you get gait abnormalities in acute spinal cord disease. So now we can already be 100% sure that Bertie does not have does not have orthopedic disease. So we can be confident this is neurological. Also, hopping is negative, another indicator of decreased proprioception. Now we'll do spinal palpation. Now, quite focally, you see that Bertie is quite painful. So quite focally, when we palpate somewhere here, Bertie reacts quite painful. And again, here. So of course, my question was, what would you do when this dog walks into your hospital? And this is again a case that we see quite common referred to us as an emergency, which is completely fine. Don't worry there. Because if we think, does Bertie have a spinal problem or neurological problem? Yes, he has proprioceptive deficits, he has obvious spinal pain. What is your top differential? So he has an acute onset, progressive, painful spinal problem. This is, of course, a young dachshund. So a compressive, degenerative type 1 intervertebral disc extrusion is your top differential. But for intervertebral disc disease or acute intervertebral disc extrusion, you have two types of treatment. One would be surgery and one would be medical. And typically, in this case, as long as they can walk, only has minimal neurological deficits, we would advise medical management. And if this dog comes to our hospital, we typically discuss with the owner that based on signalement, based on clinical presentation, we can be for 90% sure it's an intervertebral disc extrusion. At this moment, we would treat medical, which would be strict rest. And we would not recommend any further diagnostics at this point, because our concern would be if we do, for example, an MRI now, it confirms that the dog has an intervertebral disc extrusion. It will not change the plan. And then if we send the dog home and after 4 or 5 months he comes back with similar problems, maybe more severe, then we have to repeat the MRI scan anyway. So we typically, in this case, we would only do diagnostics when the dog becomes a surgical candidate. So again, that's what I said, like Eve, so hopefully after this lecture you will feel more confident to recognize these non-surgical spinal emergencies, although they can present with quite severe clinical signs. But even if your top differential is a surgical disease, like a compressive intervertebral disc extrusion, not all these dogs require further diagnostics and further treatments immediately. So that was it from me. I'm not sure if there are any questions at this point. So no questions yet. Okay, so if there are no questions, thank you very much for your attention. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will feel more confident now when you see acutely paralyzed dogs in your practice. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stephen for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.